is the little horn? What does he do? Welcome to Probe. We continue our series on the Gospel, 1844, and the Judgment. My conversation partners are again Dave Thomas and Paul Dibdall from the School of Theology at Walla Walla College. We'd like to go back to Daniel now and talk about the great enemy there in the person of the little horn. And let's do just a little bit of recapitulation. In Daniel 7, there are four beasts. The last one is the terrible beast, and if we read the description in the first part of the chapter, chapter 7, after this I saw, chapter 7, verse 7, after this I saw in the visions by night a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful, and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth and was devouring, breaking in pieces, stamping what was left with its feet. It was different from all the other beasts that preceded it. And it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns when another horn appeared, a little one, coming up among the horns to make room for it. Three of the earlier horns were plucked up by the roots. There were eyes like human eyes in this horn and a mouth speaking arrogantly. Now that's the initial description. When you come to the interpretation of this, the little horn gets a little more press. If you come to the chapter of 27, verse 23, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth that shall be different from all the other kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth, and trample it down, and break it to pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and others shall rise after them. This one shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down three kings. He shall speak great words against the Most High, shall wear out the holy ones of the Most High, and shall attempt to change sacred seasons and the law. They shall be given into his power for a time, two times, and a half a time. Then the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, be consumed, and totally destroyed. The kingship and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the holy ones of the Most High. Their kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey them. Now, what's crucial there is that the end time is characterized by the work of the little horn. And as you have this cosmic conflict again, that this is the little horn over against God's kingdom. And then there's final judgment.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Daniel, very quickly here, his attention is drawn almost exclusively to the little horn. He doesn't ask questions about the other guy. He wants to know about this one that's different. And I agree with you, Alden. It shows, you know, it seems that one of the differences is an overt interest in matters of religion in the saints. You know, and so here we see played out. Now, of course, in Daniel 8, you have some recitation of this, although it is slightly different. You have a goat and a ram, and the goat destroys the ram, and four horns come out of the goat's head. But then it says in verse 9, out of one of them came another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south and the east and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Now, it's interesting also that here the saints actually are overtaken and overrun by this little horn for a period of time. And their circumstances only resolved by an act of God in the judgment at the end.
And again, it seems to be correlated with an event at the end of time.
Yes.
That's why I think, while the Antiochus Epiphanes application is understandable, it simply does not apply to the provisions that a final conflict at the end of time.
It may be a harbinger of that, but it is not the final fulfillment. And I would say that the historicist approach to the doings of the papacy in the Middle Ages and so forth, has got to at least have some kind of expansion or extension for it to be the great and final one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might also be an example of what we have referred to as beastly behavior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it has to have some kind of global expansion if it's going to satisfy the globalized concept of the great controversy that unfold here.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is a subject of a lot of discussion by some people. They chart the activities of the Pope and the movements of the Roman Catholic Church and so on and so forth. But at this point, it doesn't seem that that is currently globalized. See? And so we're left with the question, it seems that the kind of hostilities toward the saints that have been, and you can go back even into early Christian times and find hostilities against the saints. We are left to wonder how this time of trouble that is produced by these hostilities will be globalized.
Mm-hmm. But of course, there is another application which Adventists began to develop into, rather than just the primary focus on Rome, papal Rome or pagan Rome. And that is a more spiritual application as to how this affects at human activities vis-a-vis God. This gets into the debate of in what way does the Roman power detract from the truth about God, not just in beating up on the saints, but are there some aspects of the teachings of Rome that somehow pollute the sanctuary and distort the truth about God? Is there something there that is that hinted at in the text? Is that clear in the text?
Well, changing times and laws and so forth like
yeah.
that, you know. And of course, I mean, this is an old Protestant argument you can read, especially in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, there was a lot said about the Mass itself
mm-hmm.
as something that subverted the act of faith that by which salvation comes, at least as far as evangelical Christianity is concerned, you know.
And it's really quite intriguing when you look at some of the changes that are taking place in Catholicism. This is really quite amazing. I remember hearing a Catholic priest talk about the changes in the church that had taken in 1965. And he kind of chuckled as he concluded in so many ways. He said that it's not necessary for salvation. It's an aid to salvation. And then he said, Protestants tell us that we've become nothing but a bunch of Protestants.
But yeah, as I think about the globalization of these issues, it seems to me that there could come an alliance between quite a few diverse entities. It might be secularized governments. It might be Christian communities that are very hard lined about belief in terms of that if you don't subscribe to what they believe, you are lost. It could be, it could be alliances between Christians any organization that is attempting to be coercive, I think, should be on a list of possible contenders to create an alliance, a global alliance, that will cost believers their right to conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when I think about the time of trouble Jesus talked about, it seems to me that is the kind of thing that produces, you know, the loss of privilege of conscience creates enormous turmoil in people's lives. Mm-hmm. If you have to give up what to use an issue of conscience, you are really asking somebody to surrender an existence of integrity. And there's a long history of believers refusing to do that, mm-hmm. to prefer death.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the Bible does not tell us exactly how it's going to play out. And even when you get into Revelation, you have all these different beasts and frogs and things that are moving around. But the fact of a time of intolerance is very clear.
Mm-hmm. If one takes that, then all of these characters, whether one takes of Rome or Antiochus or any of these, they become types of the final coercive and deceptive powers.
And if they're still around at the end, they could be players.
That's right.
You know?
That's very true.
If Antiochus was still around, he might want in on that alliance.
Yeah.
No, he's not around. But
Well, there's an interesting point, and I come back, I mentioned several weeks ago Mervyn Maxwell's view of this, that when Jesus talked about the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, mm-hmm. and Maxwell is a good, solid historicist, if there ever was one, but when he talks about Jesus' disciples being surprised at a fresh interpretation, that, boy, there was something more than Antiochus, it was still in the future. Maxwell then waxes Maxwellian here, and he makes this statement. In other words, old interpretations are bound to be inadequate. Only interpretations made in relatively recent years have any chance of getting the real issues straight.
Yeah.
Which is really...
Yeah, that is interesting for a historicist to say that.
Yeah. So, as we look at the ideas that we've been really quite concerned about here... in the sanctuary and the little horn, it does come down on, in the cosmic issues, what is God like and what is the enemy like.
Yeah, and do the people who profess faith in God have the latitude to choose whom they will serve?
Yeah.
And see, I think that's a very important ingredient, because that's the only zone where love grows. Love only grows in the face of volition. Mm-hmm. If you cannot choose, then, you know, we cannot require you to love people. Mm-hmm. That love is a sort of spontaneous thing that grows in the human heart where we choose for it to grow. Mm-hmm. And if I cannot freely choose God and issues of conscience, then the prospect of love is destroyed, and the whole of God's universe becomes, the tendency is to force it into a zone that God does not want it. God is not interested in obligatory servitude.
Yeah. Huh. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was just going to ask, how does, as one sees oppressive forces at work, forces that would keep people from that freedom to choose, what is the role of a Christian in responding to that? How specific can we be in naming the beast without, condemning, without coming across in a way that is counterproductive?
Well, that was precisely the question I wanted to raise, Paul, because in the early Adventist history, A.T. Jones, for example, was a marvelous Catholic basher. And Ellen White says to him fairly pointedly, Ellen White speaking from within our Adventist heritage, the Lord wants us to follow other methods than that of condemning wrong, even though the condemnation be just. He wants us to do something more than hurl at our adversaries charges which only drive them further from the truth. I find that enormously tantalizing, because there are times when you have to call sin, sin.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to call the enemies of truth and the enemies of truth. But how do we do that without destroying ourselves?
Right.
Mm. And I think that's a very important question, one which we may want to address in the last lessons that we're dealing with. Now, next time, we're going to talk more specifically about the pre-Advent judgment. We're going to talk about how God might address such issues of how we behave towards the beast and towards the saints and so on. But that's for next time. Thank you for your contributions this time, Dave and Paul and Susan Michael. We want to thank also our program engineer. We want to also thank you, people, for listening in or Probe. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.